Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome back to Radio Islam International. We've come to the conscious consumer slot with Mufti Muhammad Hafiji from the Economics and Finance Desk of the Jamaatul Ulama of South Africa. Mufti, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, Afanisa, and all our listeners of Radio Islam International.
Well, I hope you are well, and I'm not sure if you're feeling the cold up in Johannesburg yet, but here in Durban it's pretty cold, so I know that we're looking at one of the things today, three things to know about electricity costs, so I'm sure that the cold here is going to hike those costs up.
Indeed, it's just as cold up the side in Johannesburg. I'm sure many listeners are already aware that new electricity rates kicked in on the 1st of July. It may have come as a surprise to many individuals, but municipal electricity tariffs increased by around 13 to 16%. This is indeed a huge dent in many pockets. But with that said, I think it's important to understand how electricity tariffs work. This is the first step towards taking charge of how we as ordinary consumers spend on electricity. And I think while these three concepts that I want to talk about in terms of understanding electricity costs are familiar to some people, it may definitely come as a surprise to many. The unfortunate part about discussing these three conceptual elements of measuring electricity costs is that the details of how a particular electricity bill is calculated can be so complex, it's difficult for even experts to understand. So, in the long term, the real solution is for ESCOM municipalities and even the National Energy Regulator to design simpler consumer tariffs. Because the reality is many individuals look at those tariffs and we don't understand how those figures are arrived at. In the meantime, I think these three concepts may help consumers to make sense of their electricity bill. The first concept that I want to talk about is to understand whether your personal electricity comes from ESCOM or from your municipality.
Okay.
Firstly, your charges will vary depending on where you live. So if you get your power directly from ESCOM, which is the case in many rural areas, for example, you will be charged according to a different system than if you get your electricity from a municipality. Each municipality has its own system as well. For example, in Cape Town, people with homes valued at over 1 million rand pay a basic home user charge that covers the cost of keeping them connected, no matter how much power they use.
Wow.
But some municipalities in Ekurhuleni, the east, have different tariff systems depending on how much a household uses in a month. So even municipalities have their own method of calculating the value of units of electricity that is supplied to users. So it's important to check what your own municipal system is. This is the first aspect in terms of understanding how electricity costs work, whether it's from ESCOM or your electricity is from municipality.
Okay.
The second aspect is to be aware of what we call the incline block tariff, IBT. It's helpful to understand the incline block tariff system because this is one system that goes contrary to ordinary management of money in a prudent way. Basically, the incline block tariff means that the more electricity you buy in a month, the more you pay per unit of electricity.
Okay, so that sounds unfair, though.
It does indeed. I can't explain why is this the case, but it's just the way the incline block tariff it's meant to be a tariff and it's meant to penalize in a way. So in the case of prepaid customers, it has nothing to do with how much you actually use.
Mm-hmm.
The cost is purely based on how much you buy. That means that electricity is one of the rare cases where it's really not a good idea to buy in bulk. You're better off buying electricity week to week or just buying enough at the beginning of each month to keep you going. So it's cheaper to top up with a few units at the end of each month than to buy enough to last you for, say, 2 months. So many individuals don't realize this is IBT and the incline block tariff. It's actually, in the case of electricity, it's one case where you should not stockpile, rather just buy what's enough for you and top up whenever you have to. And I personally had to learn the hard way in this regard.
Okay. it's answered some of the questions I've had people ask, you know, with regards to pay-as-you-go electricity supplies. So I think that may answer some of the questions, because people usually ask, you know, I've been putting so much, how come mine is not giving me the same amount as yours does for the same amount of money? So that may be the answer to the question.
Yes. I am looking for more details. I'm sure it's available somewhere in terms of how does it, what's the threshold where you get the maximum value. From what I understand, after some basic homework, it seems like if you're buying for a month for about 500 or not exceeding 600, between 500 and 600, you're basically maximizing value for yourself as a consumer. Anything above 600 starts to, the tariff starts to increase. So that's basically the incline block tariff. And it's, as the word suggests, the tariff is meant to penalize as you purchase more. The third aspect which I want to touch on, and it may come across to some individuals as a bit impractical, but just understand that electricity cost is a headache for many individuals. But this is the issue of how much electricity does your appliance use? This is important because you understand exactly what you are getting when you buy a unit of electricity. So what I'm referring to is looking at the exact power voltage that it takes to run your appliance. So, like example, your energy bulbs, or even your iron, or even your microwave. How many watts is it? That will help you to understand how much of electricity you actually use. So, if you take like a typical example of maybe say a light bulb, if it's a 20 watt, you just have to do a simple calculation of how much does 1 kilowatt hour of electricity cost you, and then measure it against leaving that appliance running for, say, example, a full week. And you work out over time how much would 1 kilowatt hour, how long would it last you if you were to run a specific appliance given a specific wattage? How long would it last you? So understanding how much of power each appliance utilizes also can also help in a way in terms of managing one's electricity usage. I think I'll just keep it as simple as saying that the more heat an appliance generates, the more power it's going to use. So if you take an electric kettle, for example, it utilizes quite a bit of power in a short period of time, and the more water you use or try to heat up, the more power it's going to derive in a short period of time. So that's just one example. I think the important thing to keep in mind is that we need to save electricity, at the same time use what we need, you know, not be miserly in terms of how much we need or utilize, but to just adopt some basic measures of understanding that we can minimize or manage our electricity usage in using some small basic techniques of either understanding where our electricity is coming from, whether it's Eskom or municipality, whether it's understanding the incline block tariff and how it works, or even how much a specific appliance utilizes in terms of kilowatt hours.
Okay, that's pretty interesting to understand, because you could actually save quite a bit if you just map out, you know, certain appliances that you think, like your geyser, your oven, that kind of thing, you know, that will be pulling quite a bit of electricity, especially if you're on the prepaid option.
Yes, indeed. I think what we often overlook in this last point is the issue of items that remain idle, those that do not need to be used all the time. They can be like stoves, ovens, sometimes even your heater sometimes. Doesn't have to be, it's left in idle mode, and sometimes even pulling it out of the plug socket can help in reducing how much electricity is utilized.
Okay, the next one, we're saying buying a mattress can be more complicated than you think.
Yes, but you know, while this may seem like a very meager aspect to individuals who are on the higher end of wealth, buying a mattress can be more complicated than you think in the modern world and in the South African context. Now, buying a mattress is an important decision. Let's not beat around the bush there. It's an important decision. It's just that by and large, most individuals, we don't buy more than 5 mattresses in a lifetime. We buy only a maximum of a handful of mattresses. Now, it's an important decision because we sleep for about 1/3 of our lives. It matters to make sure that we get the right kind of advice when it comes to purchasing a mattress. I think what I want to do this morning, I just want to go through a few concepts or practices which are prevailing in the market. And these conceptual practices are basically not in favor of consumers many a time. The first one I want to talk about is how price comparison is achievable in many commodities that we purchase, but is not possible when it comes to purchasing a mattress. So this is, like, you could go to a website and you could compare, maybe, say, example, the price of milk across a few supermarkets. But it's so difficult to do the same thing when it comes to purchasing a mattress. And this is largely attributed to the fact that many manufacturers of mattresses allow retailers to rebrand the mattress. So the manufacturer just simply manufactures it and allows or grants permission to the retailer to brand it accordingly. So two people could have the exact same mattress from the exact same manufacturer, but the label is different because the retailer is different and the mattress has been obtained from two different retailers. So you could have the exact same product, but you just simply won't know that the product is the same as someone else purely because of the label being different. So that's the first aspect which I find it's a bit of an enigma in terms of how comparisons are possible for other commodities but not for mattresses.
Mattresses, yes, exactly.
Naturally, when it comes to labeling being different, it leads to the second problem, which is not in favor of consumers. And this is the fact that reviews are also hard to come by. Because of the naming issue, I would be maybe, let's say, a review option is permissible and allowed for me in terms of the retailer I bought from. So I would be branding a specific mattress brand in the label that I see. And my friend who wants to buy the exact same mattress but is labeled differently, he wouldn't make the connection because my review is relating to a specific brand, whereas the mattress he may be interested in is reflecting a different brand. And so this is why reviews are also hard to come by when it comes to the purchase of a mattress. And I think this problem is leading to something which is even larger in terms of the marketplace and how consumers are treated in terms of this whole prevalence of bloggers, you know. You now have for a period of time now we're seeing food bloggers, right? Now we're seeing mattress bloggers. it's really surprising because these people actually, in many cases, get compensation for positive reviews, which eventually distorts the decision of a consumer.
But that seems to go against the consumer from beginning to end, and it sounds really unfair. So how come it's not regulated, or, you know, it just seems that something like that is really unfair to the consumer.
Indeed, it is. It's just that the mattress industry is not one that is regulated as much as others that we have in South Africa. So it's just the regulation of trading in mattresses is largely covered by the Consumer Protection Act, which is it's just a broad act covering anything that is being sold on a retail basis. It doesn't address any specific commodity or form of merchandise that is being traded in the market for consumer benefit. So this is why we find that it's not the level of regulation just fits under the broad ambit of the CPA, and there's nothing specific regulating manufacturers in terms of how they should do specific things or what kind of criteria it should meet. I think even the South African Bureau of Standards has been in disarray for quite some time now. So we don't have much in terms of regulation of the industry itself. If we do have any retailers listening to us or any manufacturers listening to us, they are welcome to give us a call and add some value to what are the details of the market in terms of trading in mattresses.
You know, you've given me something to think about. I'll be looking at my mattress with a whole new perspective.
I think it's for all of us, for me, as I said earlier on, it may seem as something very meager, but
yes.
For some of us, it's a decision you make, and you live with a mattress for a long time. You know, it's part of your life for a long period of time, and it impacts on your health eventually. So this is why it is of interest to or significance to ordinary consumers. I think what I'm finding a problem with is like how in the marketplace the practices are so selfish and not geared towards protection of consumers. So you'll find cases like retailers or salespeople trying to coerce you into buying a mattress together with something else that you didn't bargain for, like maybe a mattress protector or a bed frame or something of that sort. You know, you went in for a simple mattress because you've got a protector back home or you've got a bed frame, but they're insisting that you have to buy these other ancillary goods worth your mattress. And what's even worse is they say that the guarantee on the mattress would only be triggered if you purchase the secondary items. So that becomes even more unfair for consumers. And these are all factually transpiring in terms of the homework that has been done on the specific matter. The one last part I want to talk about is the aspect of comfort returns. You know, when you buy a mattress, they say there's a comfort return. Now, many of us think that it's as simple as you go home, you use the mattress for a week, you come back and you say, I'm not comfortable on this mattress, you're getting it. It's not as simple as that. Many a time, the comfort return is only applicable if you are exercising your right to exchange something of a similar price or higher. Comfort return is not as simple as you think. Where you just go back and say, I'm not happy, I'm not sleeping at night with this bed, I want to return it. It's not as simple as that. There are often terms and conditions which apply to that comfort return.
And human nature, we don't read those terms and conditions when we sign those slips of paper.
We just don't read them. I would assume that those terms and conditions that you refer to are not lengthy. It's something that just specifically related to the comfort return itself. So it wouldn't be a lengthy piece of information that you've got to go through and understand before effecting a purchase.
You know what gets me with this is the fact that a lot of us place emphasis on buying mattresses usually for health reasons. You know, you want a mattress specifically because you have a back problem, or in some cases, you know, for elderly people, you choose a certain kind of mattress because you feel that, or they feel they'll be more comfortable with that as they get older. But a lot of the times we choose them mostly because of our health issues, you know, having a good back support and that kind of thing. They all come down to that. And then I think secondary to that is the price factor. But now that you've explained this to me, it just gives you a whole, it opens up a whole new world where you're thinking about if that mattress is said to be the same and it's just the branding that's different, how does the consumer even start to now, you know, choose which mattress is correct for them, even though you know, the retailer is saying that this one is specifically for your back issue, or this one here gives you a better night's sleep or something like that?
You know, the point you raise is relevant in the sense that the only way a consumer can benefit themselves is to go and see as many items as possible, many stores as possible. It may consume a bit of time, but just as many other commodities that we use and last a long time in our lifetime, you know, say your house or your car, you don't just buy anything willy-nilly. You look carefully because it's a different kind of implication. It's not just an ordinary grocery item that you can use and within a week the problem is overcome. You know, it's going to be forever and persistent. So the only way is to understand what we've talked about over the past few months and maybe try and inculcate a habit of looking a bit more carefully, rather than relying on someone else's view in your casual meeting with someone that so-and-so mattress is the best for your needs. Because ultimately what could happen is you could say, let's assume you heard a word of a particular mattress that your friend is talking about. So a person goes to a store and they ask you, what's your budget? and you tell them your budget is X amount, you know, they'll tell you according to your budget.
Yes.
They wouldn't tell you based on what's the most economical decision or most health-friendly decision at the time. They'll tell you based on the amount you disclose as your personal budget.
Wow, that really is, you know, it just sounds so unfair to the consumer, and it really, really gets my goat. I just feel that then more should be done with regards to that. You know, it's not fair, and many consumers, most consumers, me for one, if you hadn't brought that to my attention, I doubt I would have ever thought about it.
It's the same here, and then many of us learn the hard way when it comes to these kind of decisions. I suppose someone who was trying to produce the information, the information is appealing to myself for my own experiences that I've had in this particular regard.
Well, I'm very grateful for you for bringing that to my attention, because, you know, when you think about it, a mattress is it's a huge expense, and two, you stuck with it for quite a long time. So I think it's one of those things, like, you know, you really have to make a decision about it, and it's a big decision for most people because it's an expensive one. But Shukran, we appreciate that.
I mean, you know, if you think about the whole business scene, business is about finding a niche area and exploiting it. For anyone who is in technology and able to grasp what we're trying to talk about, there's a niche area. If you want to fulfill the needs of consumers, find a way to make it easier for them to buy a mattress. You will make some kind of money just from developing an application or some sort of guideline or some sort of tool that people can use to effect a better decision.
All right. We're looking at Stockfiles emerging as a disruptor to conventional property finance. That's interesting.
Yes, but you know, Stockfiles have traditionally been viewed as something which underprivileged communities only engage in. However, this is not the case. The 2019 All Mutual Savings and Investment Monitor is out, and it reveals some very interesting facts regarding the potential that Stockfiles have to be a game changer in terms of financing. So just to cite some basic statistics regarding Stockfiles, the traditional Stockfiles market has grown to an estimated annual value of more than 40 billion rand.
Wow.
40 billion is, you know, if you talk to bankers, 40 billion is nothing. But when I look at it, if you look at the growth over time, the growth in Stockfiles contribution has been significant. So 40 billion for me is something meaningful, and it's becoming, of course, to reckon with in terms of the finance field. Now, the research into property stock sales was included for the first time in this year's survey, and it polled about 15 founders and 105 members to these teams, and their responses reflect an interesting sense of, which I would agree with, self-empowerment, as well as dissatisfaction with traditional lenders. These two factors, which are revealed by the report, are very interesting for me, and I find it encouraging to note that when people make these contributions towards Stockfiles, there is that feeling of self-empowerment, there is that feeling of control over your finances, and it also reflects dissatisfaction with traditional lenders, which is something which is about time happens, and this is the only way traditional lenders would change the behavior if they realize that there is some kind of alternative that consumers have in terms of financing or fulfilling their basic needs of saving. What I found interesting in the survey was that the largest group was consisting of 550 members, which is quite a large group for Stockfiles. 550 members contributing anything between 3,500 and 15,000 rand to a Stockfiles on a monthly basis. People contribute a lot. Whoever is contributing quite a bit. And this particular group have accumulated 24 million in a year, which is really significant for one group of members to have accumulated. So I think for now, in citing these statistics, I just want to make it very clear to ordinary listeners that if a Stockfiles is structured in a Sharia-compliant way, it can be a meaningful mechanism and tool for saving money and even fulfilling personal needs. What I want to talk about in terms of responding to your question is that most of this, according to this Old Mutual Savings and Investment Monitor, these stock sales are being utilized for property financing, either in the sense of members of a stock sale accumulating such a large pool of resources that they can actually obtain and purchase properties. So once they register and take the formal route of a stock sale, they actually begin to own large property portfolios. So that's on the one end. On the other hand, individual members of a stock sale are utilizing the pooled resources for their personal benefit, where they fund each other's purchasing of residential premises, or even they fund each other's maybe need to extend or purchase movable items for their premises, or even enhancement projects on their personal residences. So it is really surprising to note that property stock sales are actually becoming quite an interesting alternative to conventional forms of saving or lending and moving of money between individuals. This is something which I would really gravitate toward, and I must emphasize, if the stock sale is Sharia compliant and structured in a permissible way, there can be huge potential for growth and development, self-empowerment of individuals or members to a group.
Yeah, I can see that from what you're saying. And my question I was going to ask you, I was waiting for you to finish, that I could ask you about being Sharia compliant. And, you know, are there many of these stock files that are Sharia compliant? I'm sure within the townships, especially amongst the Muslim communities.
You know, at the moment, Sharia compliant stock files, I'm not aware of any of them being registered as stock files. In the absence of registered ones, it is maybe the most prudent thing to do to maybe formulate maybe a group among work colleagues, or even a group of say neighbors can formulate their own stock sale. Even prior to being a registered stock sale, it is possible to achieve the stock sale saving in an informal way, where the money is contributed on a monthly basis, fixed amounts, for example. But when I say Sharia compliant, I mean it should not be that we draw a lot in terms of who should take the large sum of resources that has been accumulated in a particular month. You know, it should not be that way. It should more be structured on a more fair basis, where, let's say, for example, if the stock trade is making payouts, then it makes one payout to each member based on the number of members. So, for example, if you've got, say, 12 members, and there are 12 months in a year, each person receives the lump sum once in a year. In that specific example.
Okay.
So it's basically your own money coming back to you in that scenario or setting of a stock sale. It can also be that individuals contribute towards the stock sale and don't ever get a payback. The agreement is to make contributions on a regular monthly basis in equal proportion from each member, but the funds are then pooled and then accumulated for investment into a vehicle. So, for example, we accumulate a large sum of money, and as I mentioned earlier on, they accumulate so much that they are able to obtain a property, and then the property is let out, and then whatever rental income, that rental income is shared between the members in equal proportion. So it could take different forms. The issue of registering it is another aspect which can be touched on, but for purposes of our discussion, I'm not aware of any registered Sharia compliant ones, although there may be some.
All right. It would be, I think, a good thing to look into, especially for people out there. You know, you mentioned apps and things, and here's a niche area that people could look at, inshallah, within the Muslim community. If you're looking for jobs or you have the acumen to be able to do this kind of thing, it could open up the sector for you as well, inshallah.
Inshallah.
Okay, so we're moving on to our new section, which is the measuring money. And as you explained yesterday, it's looking at long-term, and we're going to unpack the concepts that are related to how we measure money. And today we're looking at, I think we're going to look at net worth. Are you going to unpack net worth for us?
Yes. Last week we looked at the savings rate, which is important in terms of planning for retirement. And I won't repeat what I said last week. Rather, appeal to our listeners to go back to that podcast. For purposes of today's discussion, I just want to unpack net worth, and I must emphasize that in discussing net worth as a measurement of money, first of all, I'm not appealing to individuals who are in the know regarding this simple, straightforward term. So individuals who may be listening and are well aware of these concepts, please just bear with us that we are trying to empower individuals who are less fortunate in terms of having someone around them who can clarify these concepts,
yes,
or even the necessary tools to clarify these concepts. That's the first thing. The second thing is to emphasize that when we talk about net worth, if you hear the definition of net worth, from a Sharia standpoint, there's a separate orientation to how or the kind of significance we add to net worth of an individual. From a Sharia standpoint, it's not an objective in itself. We're just talking about net worth as a tool towards prudent management of money. Now, if I were to just proceed on the definition of net worth, it's a very simple, straightforward term.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically measuring everything you own, the assets, right, and you minus the thing that you owe, or your liabilities, or let's say your debts. So essentially, it's a measure of your financial fitness by asking the question, how much would you have left over if you sold everything you own to pay off all your debts? It's as simple as measuring everything that you own, all your assets on the one hand, and all your liabilities, anything that you owe to people, your debts, on the other hand. When you do a subtraction of your liabilities or debts from your assets, the amount that is left over is basically your net worth. This could either be in a positive or it could either be in a negative.
Mm-hmm.
If it is positive, it is a good sign from a financial management point of view. If it is in a negative, it is not so good sign in the sense that some measures need to be adopted to improve one's measurement of money. Now, just to unpack it a little bit, I think I must mention for those individuals who are not in the know, assets will include, when you do the calculation of net worth, your assets include your savings accounts, your discretionary, your investments, your retirement or pension contributions to date from start to now, maybe a property you own, any personal belongings or values, for example, jewelry, and even the value of your motor vehicle. Any asset that has value, you include it under assets. In liabilities, it's all your personal loans, if you have a mortgage, or even a property finance that you're paying off in a Sharia compliant way, for purposes of the calculation, if it's a non-Sharia compliant loan, even then you need to include it to calculate the net worth. Student loans, vehicle loans, any binding contract that you may have, say a cell phone contract, your monthly payment, you include that under your liabilities. So in making the deduction of liabilities from assets, then the result you get is the determination of one's net worth. I must talk about why it's important to track it, because it's important. Your net worth basically is a photograph of your finances as they stand today. It's either a happy or even a positive view or a scary one, a scary snapshot of what your financial position is. In an ideal situation, the net worth should be something that is increasing on a monthly basis. For some, it may not be increasing on a regular basis, but that means that one needs to look back and adopt measures of managing money a bit better. I would say in an ideal situation, net worth should be calculated on a quarterly basis rather than a monthly basis. And I think it's important to just give you some direction in terms of how you manage your money. That's the long and short of it. It's a tool for direction in managing money. It's not an end in itself. And it doesn't determine whether you are worth living if you have a positive or negative net worth.
All right. I just want to let our listeners know that if you do have a question pertaining to something that Mufti is discussing this morning, or if it has to do with finance, you're welcome to message on 084-030-9955. That's 084-030-9955. Or if you'd prefer to call in, then the number 011-854-1548. 011-854-1548. I have a question that's come through, and it actually pertains to, I'm not sure if you would call it inheritance, but basically what is being asked is, can a person's come into some money, or they found out, I'm trying to make sense of what's written here. A person has found out that they've got, that there's money available to them, and because they've looked after the parent that this money belongs to, and the parent hasn't left it to anybody, can they take that money and pay off the debts they've incurred from looking after this parent without sharing it with the rest of the family?
Yeah. But is there any mention of the parent being deceased or still living?
No, the parent is deceased, because he said deceased parent.
Okay. From my assessment of the information that has been made available, it does seem to be related to inheritance. And if the individual is discovered that there's a sum of money which belonged to the deceased, then in strict parlance, that sum of money is part of inheritance, and by default needs to be taken into account in terms of how it is distributed among the heirs. So before we get there, we need to determine a few pieces of information, like whether the individual made a bequest of any sort, what sort of liabilities does the individual have at the time of passing on, because remember, there's a sequence to winding up of the estate. First step is usually to take care of burial expenses. The second is to deal with debts and any liabilities that the deceased might have incurred in their lifetime. And then we have your must fast and your must wajib obligations in Sharia. And then comes the distribution to the heirs. So in this kind of scenario, I would not be able to provide a conclusive answer based on the lack of pieces of information. But what I would say is that the individuals need to contact a relevant Islamic organization to determine what level of application is applicable in terms of handling those funds, purely because there's an element of debt that needs to be taken care of together with the distribution among rightful heirs.
Okay. What's being said is that cannot answer those questions, don't know any of the facts. That makes it really difficult, doesn't it?
It does make it difficult, because usually, you know, the reason why we need to be a bit more sensitive about inheritance matters is because it does involve the rights of other heirs. The last thing we want is someone to be disgruntled by a casual response given over the airwaves.
Yes, no, I understand.
Based on basic information. So I would appeal to the listener to just bear with us and rather contact me or the Jamiat office of air, either the Jamiat Ulama KZN or even the Jamiat Ulama South Africa in Fort Worth, and we could take it further gladly, inshallah.
All right, inshallah. I think listener is person is listening in, so inshallah, I hope that they will, you know, take your advice and maybe contact the Jamiat or yourself, because it's quite involved from how you're explaining it to me, and I think those questions need to be answered. And you're quite right about other members of the family, because they are, if they are siblings, or if the one of the spouses is still alive, they also inherit or are part of that inheritance as well.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Is there anything else that we need to discuss with regards to net worth? We have a few minutes left.
I think in terms of net worth, the concept in general is just something that is meant to point one in the direction of how to manage money. It's not so much a point of bragging rights that a person gets when they have a positive net worth. So it's not. It's important to keep in mind the context when it comes to discussing these measures of money itself. We're just talking about net worth as a form of giving direction to whether you are managing money or wealth prudently or not doing it so. So for that purpose, I think it's important to keep in mind that context. What I must touch on is that the concept itself is geared towards orientating ordinary individuals regarding the valuation of assets on the one hand and the valuation of liabilities on the other hand. Because oftentimes we just do the mental accounting of our assets and liabilities and assume that we are in a positive.
Yes.
Whereas if you actually put figures down on a piece of paper, you'll be surprised that you're actually not in a positive. So mm-hmm. it's important to, now and then, you don't have to do it on a daily basis or even on a monthly
yes.
basis, but maybe even on a quarterly basis, just sit down and assess your financial situation. Because this will aid in the long-term planning of expenditure, the long-term planning of what you want to do with your life, what you want to do with your family, if you have a positive financial position. Keeping in mind that having a positive financial position is also part of our deen, because we learn from many hadith that it is better for an individual to be independent than to be a parasite in a community.
Mm-hmm. All right, and then... Okay, the person's still messaging me, but I think I'll just message back to say that they really need to contact the Jumayyat because this is not something that can be dealt with on air. And then I've got another question. Is Bitcoin halal?
You know, the issue of digital assets is a very broad one. And Mufti from the Jamiat Ulama of Africa has done some extensive research on the matter. I'm not aware of the details of his research, but I'm just familiar that his conclusion was that it is permissible. And maybe the aspect of how he arrived at it is something I cannot account for.
Mm-hmm.
Just keep in mind that when it comes to these digital assets, I'm just referring to them in broad terms
yes.
rather than Bitcoin itself, because they are complicated. And I think just this week there's been a massive scandal that unfolded regarding an entity that was offering Bitcoin investments. So there's a great deal of caution when it comes to just proceeding on these type of investments on the basis of just someone saying it's possible, so we go ahead, you know, without
yes.
looking into the specifics of the company itself that is offering the Bitcoins or even hosting that kind of service to a consumer.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so generally I could just say to the person that it is permissible, but be careful if you are investing to, you know, that you're using somebody that's reliable, somebody you can trust.
You've got to be careful, yes.
Yeah.
You know, digital money itself, currency is becoming, it's likely to become the order of the day, but we are not yet there, more so in the South African context.
Mm-hmm. All right. Mufti, Jazakallah Khair for another very informative session, and inshallah we'll catch up with you next week for more of the same. And you've really got me thinking about this whole mattress thing.
Alhamdulillah, shukr. I hope the information has been of benefit to ordinary consumers.
Yes, definitely. Well, that's what you're aiming for, and inshallah, I'm sure that many people out there, myself included, are gaining much from these little programs that we're having. And I'm sure that if you want to know more, and if you've missed any of the shows and maybe want to catch up, then you can get the podcast off our website. Just look up the Conscious Consumer and you'll find them there, inshallah. They've been put on since the beginning when we started, so you won't have any issue with regards to that. Mufti, Jazakallah Khair. Enjoy the rest of your weekend, and we'll talk again next week, inshallah.
Ameen. Jazakallah khairan for having me.
Ameen.
And I look forward to the next segment, inshallah.
Inshallah. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum salam.
Well, to our listeners, Jazakallah Khair for listening in, and hopefully we'll catch you all again next week Sunday with the Early Morning Sunday Show with me, Anisa Isaac. And I hope that you're finding this, informative. And don't forget our... Radio Islam's your ability to engage with Radio Islam is taking place at the moment at the Masjid al-Salihin in Lanesia. You're welcome to go through, and I'm sure that if you have any ideas, any suggestions, any complaints, you'd be able to give it to the people there, including our presenters, some of our board members, and inshallah this can help us take this forward, make the station better, as Brother Faisal was saying earlier on as well. From me, I'll be back during the week, inshallah. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu.